Hello, and welcome to the DMV Business Show, a weekly show where we get to meet local business and community leaders in the DC, Maryland, and Virginia area. They get to impact their story and how they got there. You can expect to hear advice and learn about their journey and how they went from point A to point B. My name is Otto Sevilla, and I'm a commercial real estate advisor in the local DC, Maryland, and Northern Virginia area. I have been very fortunate to have worked with many amazing entrepreneurs and executives, from startup founders to international Fortune 500 companies. And one of the things I love about what I do is I get to form these great relationships with some interesting people. I get to know them and I learn about how it all started. And I love hearing a good business story. When I'm not working in commercial real estate, I just also happen to be the host of this show. So please enjoy and welcome to the DMV Business Show. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the DMV Business Show. I'm your host, Otto Sevilla, and today our special guest is Martin Mayorga. And I'm sure you've heard and seen the Mayorga name everywhere, especially if you're in the DMV area and you're visiting your local Costco. You can't not miss their bags. Martin is the founder and CEO of Mayorga Organics. Welcome to the show, Martin. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Of course. So as I mentioned before I hit record, I like to get the audience to get to know you a little better. Were you born here? Where are you from originally?
I was actually born in Guatemala. I only lived there a little bit when I was a kid. There was a massive earthquake and, you know, I think about half the capital was basically wiped out. So we ended up going to Nicaragua from there where my dad's from or was from. And we're there for a little bit. Then a revolution came and had to leave there and then went to Costa Rica. Had to leave there after about a year because there was a lot of Nicaraguans who fled, ended up in Costa Rica. Then we went to Peru, where my mom's from, and inevitably came to the U.S. And kind of were able to build a life here.
Sure. Where, out of all those, I guess, four Latin American countries, where were you the most or the longest?
I think the longest stretch in those countries was Nicaragua. And frankly, for me, Nicaragua is where I feel like I'm from. It's where I just have the most memories. And my dad was from there. And honestly, when I think about home, as far as Latin America, it's Nicaragua. Okay. Guatemala, I have good memories, especially like camping by Lake Atitlan and different things. But Nicaragua, I think, has deeper meaning for me.
What do you remember? What age were you living in Nicaragua? How old were you?
It was from about 3 to 7.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Those are where, what part of Nicaragua?
We were right outside Managua.
Okay.
My dad was from León. You know, he was him and his brother, a single mom. And thank goodness at 16, he decided to come and figure out how to learn English in the U.S. and got himself later an education in the U.S., which really gave us something to fall back on when we came to the States, because he spoke some English and then he had a U.S. education.
Okay. So outside of Managua, like Masaya?
Yeah.
Okay.
No. We lived outside Managua. Like, I mean, it was Managua, but it wasn't in the capital, right?
It wasn't
in the city.
Okay.
So it was like a suburb of Managua. But yeah, it was like off Carretera Masaya that way. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was still Managua.
I was born in Managua, but I came to this country at a very young age. Again, my parents fleeing the revolution, where Los Sandinistas, the communists, came into power back in the 80s. I was very little. But even so, now people ask me, I say I'm from Nicaragua, even though I didn't grow up there. I grew up here in D.C. in the D.C. metro area, but I still have a lot of family in Managua. My mom's from Granada. I still have family in Granada. And my dad was in León studying. He was in dental school there when the revolution started, and they wanted to send him to the mountains. So that was one of the main reasons we fled, because my grandfather knew that if he goes there, he's probably not coming back home.
That was a challenge with my dad's situation. Was, you know, he was involved in some of the political side of things, and he was a big proponent of implementing a democratic capitalist economy, having been educated in the U.S. And that was not a popular opinion once the FSLN took over. So, you know, and I remember my dad telling me stories about, you know, young boys, they either were fighting or they're killed by, you know, it was tough. I mean, they would take kids, you know, 14, 13 years old and send them out to the mountains and say, look, you're going to go fight. So, it was a crazy time. I mean, it was one of those things that I didn't realize how intense and kind of out of the norm it was until I grew up here. And I would tell people stuff and they'd be, what? And they thought I was making it up, because it's definitely not the norm of what you deal with in the U.S.
Yeah. So when you left Peru, Martin, and you came to the States here, how old were you roughly?
About 12, I think.
Okay.
Just shy, like 11.
Sure. Yeah. And then you, the family, you all arrived to the DC metro area, or?
No, we came to Miami first. And actually, okay. my dad and my brothers were able to get to Miami. So my sister and my mom and I stayed behind in Peru for a little bit. I think it was a lot to do with visas and being allowed to enter, et cetera. So going through that process, and then we lived in a apartment here in Miami. I remember it was a very small place, very crowded, but it was nice because there was no wars or chaos. I mean, because even when we were in Peru, that was during the Shining Path days. So we couldn't really go into the capital. There was a lot of nights with no power because it's Shining Path. Sendero Luminoso would, you know, blow up a power plant and all of a sudden you wouldn't have power for 2 weeks. And like everywhere we were, there was a little bit of, you know, chaos, right? There was Guatemala and the earthquake and living in the car afterwards. There was a really nice break in Costa Rica, which was a beautiful place. And compared to Nicaragua, very calm. Had to leave there very quickly though, unfortunately. And then Peru had its share of issues with the Shining Path and some of the violence that was taking place in those days. So arriving in Miami, it was, you know, it was like a vacation. I felt like and I always joke, you know, the way we left Nicaragua, very abruptly, my dad came home one day, like kind of frantic. He's like, hey, we're going to Disney World. We're going right now. And I was a kid. I'm like, this is great. We're going to Disney World, you know? And he's like, just grab whatever. And we just grabbed our things and got in the car, drove to the border and left everything. And just, that's it. Never turned back. So for me, it was like arriving in Costa Rica was almost better than going to Disney, because we could ride our bikes and we would, you know, walk around in the woods and go to creeks and do like kid stuff that we hadn't gotten a chance to do in Nicaragua. But Miami was then the next level of that, which was, and Miami in the 80s had some issues. There was a lot of crime here with the cocaine and the narco scenario that took place here, but it was the U.S. It was just so different. You know, I didn't feel that kind of danger and that kind of overwhelming feeling I felt in Latin America in those days.
Sure. So you're around 12 and you arrive, I guess that's almost like middle school age, junior high school. When you arrived here, did you know English at all?
Not much. No. Okay. You know, as a kid, you like the American shows and so you pick up some things, but that was one of my bigger challenges, especially because we moved to the DC area very quickly after being in Miami. And I'll tell you, in the 80s, in Maryland, there weren't many Latinos. And those of us who were around were typically like, it was like the kids of like parents who worked the World Bank or, you know, there weren't many of us. So honestly, learning English was a top priority and assimilating was a top priority, which, you know, in hindsight, I look back on it, it's like, it kind of sucks that you have to give up a little bit of your identity or a lot of your identity to fit in. But as a kid, that's like the ultimate survival tool, right? Like you want to fit in to not, because you get picked on. I got picked on all the time and I got in a lot of fights because I didn't speak English. And, you know, kids in the 80s weren't as aware maybe as they are now. And you resolve things differently too, where, you know, a lot of it became physical and, you know, it was a little tumultuous in its own way.
Sure. Where in Maryland did you live when you arrived? What city?
We were in the Rockville area.
Okay.
You know, and even here we bounced around a lot, you know, just my dad struggled because having come from Nicaragua during the revolution, as you might be aware, I mean, during the 80s and the Cold War, it was like nobody really knew who was on what side. And if you came from Nicaragua, who had just gone full communist, then the assumption is, well, you might be a spy or whatever it might be. And my dad struggled for years to find work. Mm-hmm. So even in Maryland, we rented house after house after house. I remember like every 6 months or maybe a year. Like, so there was a lot of, you know, instability at that point as well, too. Oh, up in Maryland and
Rockville. And then,
well, I went to Bullis and St. Andrews and Churchill.
Okay, got it. Okay, all right.
And then stuck around. I went to Montgomery College for a year, and then I transferred into Georgetown from there.
Okay, growing up here, or I guess we can even go back as your childhood in Latin America. What were you into? Do you remember whether here in the States or even before that in Latin America, as far as, you know, sports or any hobbies?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in Latin America, it's funny because first in Guatemala, I was super young, and Nicaragua, it was tricky because it was so restricted. Luckily, I was the youngest of four, so I had just kids around me, which is my brothers and my sister. But we didn't go to school for about a year during the revolution, so there was just a lot of, like, kind of like what we just went through during the pandemic, right? We couldn't really leave our house. And that was stressful, to be honest, the last year in Nicaragua. Just a lot of gunfighting at night and just moments of chaos that kind of would spill over where we lived. And, you know, I tell people all the time the story of when I was little, we used to collect bullet shells. You know, we would get up in the morning after all the fighting and we'd run outside and had a big bag of bullet shells, and most of them were AK-47 shells. And then I remember one of my better memories, like getting a great baseball card. I got a live round from a 44 Magnum, and that was a big deal to me. And so for me, that was super normal. I mean, we also, my dad was, he played baseball and he loved baseball. So we always used to play like some sort of stickball type of scenario with the family. So it was interesting because I had people to play with because my brothers and my sister. But right before the revolution, I do remember a lot of fun trips, right? A lot of, you know, the beaches are nice there. My dad was always all about, you know, getting out of the city and going up to the mountains. And he befriended the Cubans who had left there, had left Cuba in the 50s and 60s, and literally with tobacco seed in their pocket to go start a new life in northern Nicaragua. I learned a lot about that. Just the tobacco world and the culture and the people and the Cubans kind of struggles and the resiliency to start over somewhere else. And so there were some great memories too. I mean, I remember eating whole fried fish at the beach and, you know, going up to the mountains and hanging out with these Cuban guys that we drink their little coffees and play guitar. And, you know, so for me, honestly, when people hear about my history as a kid, they kind of think about the negative. For me, it was all positive. I mean, nobody was telling me how bad things were, right? Yeah. It was all just what was around me. So I think I, you know, what really hit me was when I started going back in 91 when I was 18. And, you know, Violeta Chamorro came in and she was the first, you know, democratically elected president in a long time. And I got hit with this duality of, I felt really at peace and kind of at home, even like, I don't know when the last time you've been to Nicaragua or any of these countries, but like, there's a lot of stuff burning, right? People burn trash or whatever, but like, even just the smell of like the roadside, like trash fires was nostalgic, you know, and I had forgotten about it. And then like all the smells hit you and all the like, I was like, oh man, this is, I feel right here. You know, I don't have to put on this facade here. I don't have to be embarrassed that I like certain foods that smell a certain way or whatever. But then I was also hit with a lot of sadness because I saw a country that I consider my home just destroyed. And I saw poverty that I had seen as a kid. And really, for some reason, the poverty affected me and the way people struggled affected me very young. But then I saw it get worse rather than better. So it was this kind of duality of like this kind of like refinding a big part of me and the reality of who I am with the sadness of like, man, things have just gotten worse here and it feels like it can never be turned around.
You know, it just, when you tell me this, it reminds me, even though I grew up here, so I can say, I mean, I'm more American than anything, but I've been to Nicaragua many times. I have now three young children, three boys, and I even took them back there, what, maybe 3 years ago? And I was driving the other day, this week, somewhere here in Maryland, and I had the windows and I'm like, oh my God, remind me so much of back home. Back home, I still consider Nicaragua, even though I left at a young age. And my wife's like, really? And they were burning something. And yeah. It's just that smell. And I was like, wow, okay. And it's true that the first time I went back, I think I was 13 or 14, and we had to get a special exception because we were coming back to bury my grandmother, my mother's mother in Granada. And they were holding the funeral just for us to arrive from the airport and then go to Granada from Managua. And it was shocking. I don't remember anything because I grew up in DC, but it was just shocking to see the poverty, especially now it's gotten a little bit better compared to the first time I went there, that the kids hanging out in the corners there. I would mostly be in Managua and, you know, panhandling and other things. Even the last time I was there 3 years ago, I saw less of that, still there, but less of that. And it just shocked me because here I am as a 13-year-old and I'm coming from America and it's just like, wow.
And it's funny because that's one of the big things that hit me. And it's funny, you just reminded me of something I hadn't really put together into like what really also was a big push for me to start doing business in these countries in a positive way. Because I remember my first trip back in 91, I mean, the amount of kids that were orphaned after the revolution and everything was off the charts and just, you know, had to go do whatever they could do on the streets. But one of the biggest issues they had as a country was kids that were addicted to sniffing glue. And a lot of it was a function, exactly. And it was a function of foreign companies that go there to produce chemicals and glues and whatever, disposing of it illegally, kids get their hands on it and they become addicted. And, you know, when their brains are developing and when they're supposed to be getting an education, they're just looking to get high. What's even more sad is it's not just to get high, it's because they're hungry and it curbed their appetite. And I remember at 18, like, wait a minute, this is incredibly reckless and inhumane that there's companies that come into these countries are creating this complete damage to, you know, generations of kids and nothing gets done about it. And it's just okay. And that the little pieces start to kind of come together as like a puzzle for me when I was, at 18, I was like, there's just something so wrong with society. And unfortunately, the countries that I care about, that I love, that I feel are part of me are the ones that are getting the brunt of it. That return was so impactful to me. And, it was things like that, that really, really hit me.
Martin, let me ask you, because you said you have four other siblings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're the youngest out of four. Did they
three,
all
three, others,
oh, three. Yeah. Okay. Three others. So you're the youngest out of the total four. Did the other three feel something similar when they went back or when they have gone back to Nicaragua?
You know, I think I was the only one to go back. And first of all, when we went back in 91, when it was safe to go back, right. Mm-hmm. I was 18. My sister was 20. They're in a different point of life where I think almost like that window had closed on them more. Now, my second oldest brother, Carlos, he works at the IFC. He's always been very much into engaging Latin America, being a positive contributor. He does it through his world of finance. But I think because I was younger, and honestly, I've always been an empathetic person. Because like I said, I've had moments in markets where I remember seeing a little boy and his mom come and beg my mom and I for money. And I remember asking my mom, like, why don't they just buy groceries like we do? And I didn't understand poverty, right? And I remember it hit me really hard when mom was like, they just can't. And I would ask her questions, like, well, why can't they? Why can't they just do what we do? And, you know, as a kid, you know, 3, 4, 5 years old, understanding the world in that way. And then it affected me and I felt weird. I felt strange, like, driving in a car and seeing a kid my age, you know, and you probably saw it when you went back there that they pick up sticks of wood and bundle them and they'll walk 5 miles to go make a dollar. Mm-hmm. And I felt guilt as a little kid. You know, I was like, this is so strange. Like, here I am in a nice car driving and this kid's like having to hustle just to like eat, you know. And so I think maybe my age, and there's something in me that I think I have an empathy level that's a little higher than most, and it really stuck with me.
And the reason I'm asking is I only have a younger sibling and we have a 9-year gap in age difference, so it's a big difference. But I also have other family here, cousins similar in age, maybe a little younger and older in Southern California, other parts in this country, and a lot of them were born in Nicaragua too, immigrated here as well during that time, and even have cousins who grew up there and left Nicaragua, maybe in their teenage years, here to America. but a lot of them never go back. And yeah. And I even talked to my younger brother, who was not born here. He was born here in this country, but they don't have interest. And it's interesting. That's why I asked, because for me, my first time back there as a 13-year-old, and then literally even through high school and college, I would almost spend the whole summer there, my summer break for months in Nicaragua, mostly in Managua or other parts. It was just, and I don't know why, it was just innate in me. I wanted to be there. And even now, after having my own family again with my wife, who's not at all from Nicaragua, and my three boys, like I took him back. I took him back home to visit my grandmother and my family and everyone else there. So that's why I'm asking, just because even my family who were born there or even grew up there, they have no interest.
You know, I always find it interesting, this the concept of the family dynamics and what a childhood experience can be, to how it can be interpreted so differently just by being a different individual, right? I think part of it was, I think because my dad never positioned our situation as chaotic or as stressful or as bad or as scary. And I never took it that way. I think for my sister and, you know, I think for some of my siblings, it was more like, thank goodness we got out of that. I never want to look back, you know? And for me, it was like, I was kind of cool. And maybe my wiring is like that. My wiring is very like, I like adventure. And I see it in my son. You know, my son's a kid that I remember when I wanted to learn about cacao and I had an opportunity to go to Belize to meet with some producers. He's like, well, tomorrow, can you come? I was like, sure. And I turned to my son, who was like 11 then. I'm like, you want to go to Belize? He's like, yeah. You know, like, so it's like this genetic thing that I think I have too, which is like this sense of adventure. And, you know, my dad was very fortunate after he was able to start a career very late in his, at his age, he was able to, you know, travel to exotic places and, you know, back before emailing or sending pictures and all this stuff, it was like he would come back and he would develop the pictures. I'm like, wow, he was in Indonesia, he was in Africa, and it was all very exotic and cool. And to me, it made me realize like the world is so much more interesting than living this very vanilla life in your bubble, which frankly I think the DC area tends to have, outside of the, you know, some of the international World Bank, IDB, IMF type of, you know, world. So for me, it was more just that sense of adventure. And I remember my dad would come back from countries and like, he brought me this blowgun from Indonesia with darts, and you could like blow the darts into a wall and like just really cool stuff. You know, it felt very like, as a kid, like very interesting. So I think it opened my eyes to like, I don't want a routine life, and I never appreciated one. So I think it's that for me, it's just that genetic situation where I liked the uniqueness of my background and my culture, and I wanted to hold on to it.
You know, I never thought about it until you just mentioned it right now, Martin, and it's very true, because I'm a person that I want to see the world internationally. You know, wife and I have traveled, you know, Greece, Croatia, Italy, whatever, you name it, Paris. And then now that I think about it, the other family, the other relatives, even my younger brother, I don't think he's ever stepped foot outside of the U.S. besides maybe go to Nicaragua once or twice because of family emergencies. And I tell him, I'm like, don't you want to go travel? Like, go visit here with your best buddy or whoever? He's like, no, you know, I'm like, okay. And even my family, my cousins in California, Southern California, just maybe go to Mexico. There's right there for them. And I'm like, okay, but it's true. It's that sense of adventure. Now that you mentioned, as far as you traveling also and your dad coming home with all these little trinkets and things for you, you were like, wow. And it must be then. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. And even the adventures we had in Nicaragua. I mean, like I said, we used to go to Esteli all the time for cigars. And I'll never forget one time we were driving and a cow jumped in front of the car. We hit the cow. It was like hitting a brick wall. And the farmer wanted to like beat up my dad because his cow was worth money. We had to negotiate with a guy to like repay him for his cow. And it was a whole thing. It was like, but to me, like, those are the interesting stories in life. Right. And yeah. I don't know, that stimulated me, and that stimulated like just my, it got me, even now, I mean, I love going to, like, I love Uganda. I love the more remote, more exotic, the more like out of where I feel out of place, and even like don't speak the language and I look different. Like, I enjoy that. You know, I think it just shows me the interesting diversity of the world.
Yeah, no, that's good. So you go back there at 18 and you're like, I want to do something. I want to help. And then I assume then you come back home to Maryland, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you say then, you went, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say you were also, well, this happened prior to Georgetown, you entering mm-hmm. Georgetown University.
Yeah.
In Georgetown, what were you studying?
International Business and Finance.
Okay.
You know, I was in a trajectory to go to Wall Street. I was doing an internship, I think in 19, I waited tables. I was a waiter at a bunch of different restaurants from 16 to like 21. But I wanted to learn the entire world of the whole international trade side of things, because it's little things like I told you, like the glue, you know, these kids that were addicted to sniffing glue, it was seeing the prices of things like a cigar that's basically rolled up leaves, just marketed to be something special and, you know, 20x the price, and coffee and all these things. And I was like, there's something here. I have to figure this out. So I did an internship at the World Bank. I did as much as I could to understand that side of the world. And I wanted to get into like import, export, and understand kind of the trade side of things. And just kind of became very self-taught. This is when the internet was like very young, right? You had to dial up and, you know, AOL and all that stuff. But I just wanted to understand it. And then I realized like, okay, if I study finance, I'd have a better shot of also understanding how the money side works. And I've been blessed in the fact that my dad was a brilliant economist. My brothers are brilliant finance people. Like, it's just, that's part of our genetic makeup too. I didn't utilize it well. I had, you know, the reason I went to 3 high schools is because I got kicked out of 2. So I didn't leverage my inherited intelligence until I realized that I wanted something more out of life. And frankly, my best friend passed away when I was 17. And, you know, there's a lot of things that I was like, okay, life can just turn on you. And it's not about just partying and having games. So I think, you know, after my friend passed away, going back to Nicaragua, doing these things, I was like, I gotta really do something valuable with my life.
Sure. So once you graduate Georgetown, do you go into a career as far as international or finance or?
I didn't graduate Georgetown.
Okay.
So what's interesting about Georgetown is I was a couple classes away. My cigar business was in full swing. I had 2 great professors help me during the cigar business. One was a professor who taught entrepreneurship, which was very leading edge back then. Being an entrepreneur was not cool back then. It was strange and kind of like you're kind of a, you know, not a loser, but you were trying to figure your life out when you're an entrepreneur. You weren't on a track. But I had a professor help me with my business plan, and I had a business law professor help me kind of with different structure and, you know, understanding the business world. But what happened was I built my cigar business. Well, I started my cigar business. I was doing good business locally, and the Washington Post wrote a front page business section story on what I was doing. And I remember emailing my professor saying, hey, look what came out. This is something I'm working on. I was very proud of it, right? I got called into the dean's office thinking like, I'm going to get some sort of like, hey, good job, blah, blah, blah. And they just read me out and they're like, listen, you're not here to promote yourself. You're here to get an education. You're here to go to Wall Street. You're here, you know, to take an offer from JP Morgan had made me an offer, and I was kind of sitting on it. They were upset with me. They were very bothered by the fact that I had the nerve to go do my own thing and figure out something that was meaningful to me, which was working in a country that I loved and I wanted to give back to. So I said, all right, well, I'm not going to support and be a part of this anymore. You know, I can't, for a piece of paper that says that I completed some courses and checked off lists, it wasn't worth it. So I got out of college. I went, and I would go to Nicaragua like every other week and sleep at the factory. I'd get there on Fridays, sleep at the factory, come back Mondays, and I made my classes so I'd have long weekends. Then I just went back down to Nicaragua. And thank goodness I did, because that's what got me engaged more on the coffee side, where I learned about, you know, I was in the valley a lot. I'd go up to the mountains and I'd hear about coffee. I'd spend some time at farms, and we had a family friend that grew coffee and explained things to me, and I really understood the challenges that were faced by farmers. And, you know, because I didn't graduate, I had the time and the wherewithal to be in Nicaragua, and, you know, get to where I am now.
That's Great. What year did you start the cigar business? Were you in Georgetown in college?
Yeah, I was at Georgetown. Okay. You know, it was an interesting time because I started it, and like right when I started, there's this cigar boom, which is the weirdest thing ever. I mean, it's just funny how trends happen. And like everybody became a cigar smoker out of nowhere. And like cigar lounges started popping up, and all of a sudden it was like the cool thing to do, which I don't like because by the time something's cool, I feel like, okay, it's going to be done soon. Mm-hmm. So in 2001, I started in the cigars like 94, 95. I then started bringing coffee in 96.
Okay.
97, I started roasting coffee. So I had the businesses overlapping, the cigars, the coffee. I worked with a company called JR Cigars. They had exclusive distribution rights for my cigars, so it gave me time to do coffee. I had negotiated private label relationships for Romeo and Julieta, Monte Cristo, some of the top cigar brands, because I knew those people well. But then in 01, I realized I felt almost guilt about cigars and smoking and the health issues. And I really saw that in coffee, there was just an opportunity to really move the needle in some way. So I sold the cigar brand in 01.
Okay.
I was doing about 3 million cigars a year in distribution. We had a nationally distributed brand. And I parlayed that into really getting deeper into the coffee world.
And by then, Mayorga Organics had already existed, right?
Well, I started as Cafe Mayorga in 97. By 99, I already had my first shop. We were full blown in coffee when I sold the cigars. Interestingly, what's funny is I named the Cafe Mayorga and I had to change it to Mayorga Coffee because back in the late 90s, even having a brand with something in Spanish basically put you in the class of tortillas, beans, and you belong next to Goya on the grocery shelves and you weren't quality, you know. And honestly, that's still a struggle. This concept that you either have an ethnic product or a specialty product and that there's no specialty ethnic products is still something I fight with. But yeah, I changed it to Mayorga Coffee and we became Mayorga Organics after 2011, 2012, when we supported producers who were struggling with coffee because of a rust that was impacting the crop. We planted chia and then we realized that to be a good partner to coffee farmers, you just have to be a good partner to the farmers. And if that means planting chia and other products, then that's what we'll do. And we'll sell other organic products, which is part of what we do now.
Sure. And you first started with the whole coffee production market in Nicaragua, right? Was that the first?
No. I learned how to roast in Nicaragua with literally like a hand turn, like 55-gallon drum. But I started bringing in green coffee into the U.S. and selling it to big roasters here in the US. And then what happened was I realized that people who were in the coffee industry were so afraid to deal with a supplier out of the country, which seemed so strange to me. It's like, wait a minute, your entire business is based on a product that is imported. Why don't you want to deal with the source directly? Right. Mm-hmm. And it's basically just mitigating risk. And it's just people were not comfortable with it. So I was selling containers of coffee to two big roasters, but they're really the only ones in there. They wouldn't give me that much business. And then I realized the industry doesn't get it. The industry doesn't understand its own supply chain. So I need to become a roaster. So I started roasting in 97 for that reason, because I realized if roasters won't buy from me, I got to become a roaster and create the market myself.
And you start roasting here?
Yeah, in Rockville.
In Rockville, in Maryland. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So that's your first roasting facility in Maryland.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, and honestly, we're way before our time. It's funny now, I kind of laugh. I like the whole industry now is talking about direct trade and this and that. It's like, it's not that big a deal. You just buy directly from farmers. I mean, I don't see why the industry glorifies it so much. And it's almost insulting that it's glorified so much because it makes it seem like farmers, it's almost like they're savages and our countries are these like dangerous places. And these, you know, new age Indiana Jones companies are brave enough to go down there and buy directly from these people. And it's not like that at all, you know, and that's what I've been doing for 23 years.
Back then, though, you were the first one sort of doing that, right?
We're the only ones, yeah. I mean, we've been leaders in this whole movement we're still leaders in the way we're doing things and how engaged we are and the diversification, the way we negotiate, you know, our financing for our producers from banks. I mean, my issue is that we're always probably 5 years ahead of the industry. But that's because we're truly engaged in it. you know, we're not doing things just for marketing.
Yeah. Now, back then, though, you weren't in the shelves of all these stores. How were you doing it?
Honestly, back then, once I started roasting, it was so easy to get business because, and this was what's funny to me, our direct model gave me better coffee and better pricing. So I would go on the shelves and I would compete with national brands with price, no problem, because I had such an efficient supply chain. And our quality was, back then, the only selling point I had was we had better pricing and our product is actually fresh, because most stores had stuff that came off a warehouse that had been sitting for 3 months, right? So the quality of our coffee was just exponentially better than anything on the market. I had a client list that was 20 pages long. I was doing private label for Dean DeLuca. I was doing, there was chains, you know, that aren't in business anymore, but we were doing, you know, regional chains. We had solid retail business, and any coffee shop that served coffee, we sold to them. At that point, those first 3 to 4 years, maybe 3 to 5 years, if I won an account, I would get it because nobody else was doing what we're doing.
Okay. So it was pretty easy to win the business then back then.
Super easy.
Okay.
I screwed it up because my ego wanted me to get into retail. And so I started opening shops, and that's where things got a little interesting.
So you had a little coffee shop, sort of like Starbucks, some or smaller versions?
No, I did it much better. We did, our first shop ever was a 6,000 square foot lounge.
Wow.
I had a roaster. We had an espresso bar. We were doing latte art in 99 before people even knew what it was. We had live music. We had a full bar where we did loaded lattes. So you get a latte, you put some alcohol in it. It was like,
so that's an experience. Biggest,
yeah. And yeah. We'd roast there, and every batch that we roasted sold out on the spot. My biggest issue there was that the fire department would come and make people leave because we were over capacity all the time in 6,000 square feet. So we wanted to do things differently. We did that shop, and then we started opening more kind of like typical cafe coffee shops. And then I just realized it's a boring existence, to be honest. It's not for me. I want to move the needle in coffee. When you have coffee shops, you're kidding yourself if you think you're in the coffee business, because you're basically selling milk and pastries and sandwiches and salads and sugar and muffins. And then the coffee category is about this big. So I realized we're working super hard. It's kind of a nightmare. I'm not really somebody that's going to let staff, you know, we had customers that would treat people badly. And I'm like, you paid $4 for a drink. Like, let's not disrespect my staff just because you feel this entitlement. And it just became this stressful thing that just wasn't working for us. Meanwhile, wholesale just kept growing and growing and growing and growing. Costco was one of my first big customers in late 2000. So, you know, we got into that bigger wholesale very early on. And I realized, wow, there's volume out there. And if I'm smart, I can build a good business around that volume. Then I can move the needle. Then I can go back to my farmers that I was buying 100 bags from and say, I'm going to buy 2 containers. I'm going to buy 4 containers and really make an impact. And that was just addicting. It was more just like, this is where the change takes place. Not in the little hyper small specialty ego driven side of the business, but the volume side of the business, because the volume side of the business is what created the systemic poverty in our countries to begin with. So why would I fight it with the minute part of the business? I'm going to fight it to get, I want the big business.
Yeah.
That's what I'm focused on.
Is Costco now, Martin, I'm curious, sort of the biggest purchaser you guys have?
They're one of, we okay. rotate with a lot of clients. We do a lot of private label and work with some national brands that we don't disclose because of,
sure.
you know, private label agreements, et cetera. But they're definitely big. And, you know, when we do promos with them, they become the biggest, but we trade them off. And I'll tell you, there's 2 national massive clients that we worked with that I stopped selling to because they're greenwashing and they were using us as token minorities. And as far as large companies with values, I think our current client base is about the only ones that exist to my knowledge. That's a tricky part.
Are you nationwide with Costco?
We do rollouts with them that are nationwide, yeah.
Okay. I remember the first time, I can remember many years ago, I'm into Costco and then I see my yoga and then I'm like, obviously, I mean, your bag, the color, you can't miss it, you know, with the yellow and the red. And then I see Nicaragua and I'm like, hold on. And I have to do a double take. And I was like, oh, wow. But it's great to see what you guys have built.
Yeah, it hasn't been easy. I mean, I've probably been technically bankrupt 10 to 12 times. We've had lawsuits. We've had embezzlements. I've had all kinds of stuff happened. And there was about a year where I couldn't sleep without sleeping pills, but you know, we paid our dues and we got through things. And I think we found our sweet spot. And frankly, when I stopped chasing money and got out of my own way with my ego, and I realized that I just want to make an impact, that's where we are now. We're doing very well with it, because I think it just, once you're passionate and you bring a group of passionate people on board, it just kind of snowballs. And that's where we are right now. We're not a company that seeks, you know, we don't even go out and look for press coverage, or we just want to sell. We want to sell product, and as long as it's organic and it's good quality that we're going to pay our producers well for, then that's what we'll do.
It's interesting you say that, as far as not focusing on the money and focusing on the other things. And I've heard that many times, you know, people say chasing the money, the dollars, but then once they refocus that energy and effort elsewhere, things just change and clicks and it goes to a different level.
Because if you're chasing money or chasing any end result, you're just chasing a predetermined, predefined, linear, black and white point in life, right? And where we are, there's a gray area, there's a gap, there's a need, there's an opportunity. And by default, if you are willing to, you know, zig and zag into those gray areas and those opportunities and those needs, and you're doing it in an authentic, passionate way, it just works out, right? And those gray areas and those needs, opportunities translate into scale, differentiation. I mean, all the things that in business are rewarded, but people don't understand that it's more about the gray area and understanding the gaps than looking for that point you want to get to, where I want to make X million. I mean, you kind of kill the fun to me. To me, making money is boring if you look at it that way. It's interesting to find something you care about, you're passionate about, that everybody thinks you're insane can do, that everybody thinks that you're an idiot and you're wrong, and that they don't even believe you because they think it's too altruistic to build the company that actually can help people. And then you prove everybody wrong, you feel good about yourself, everybody that works with you feels good about themselves, everybody benefits, and you make money. Yeah. So that's kind of how we operate.
It's the impact. What would you say is that drives and motivates you now?
Impact. I mean, you just use that word, but for me, I like results, and the impact that we can make as a company creates those results that are human, right? It's that human result of, you know, just, I was on the phone with our Honduran producers who we sign our contracts with in June, so they can get our contracts to finance the entire crop at a better interest rate. And we're looking about maybe $150,000 to $160,000 of extra money we're going to put in for a project to either help them with their honey and some of their diversification projects or whatever it is. And like, that's the fun part to me. Honestly, I can't stand marketing. I think it's dishonest. I think it's dirty. I think it's kind of like the way products are marketed and the way you have to play the game, I hate, because I feel like it's trickery more than just, I like the impact. I like to get a customer email saying, hey, I drink your coffee every morning. I love it. Like the reality, I like the human side of things. And the impact isn't just about producers. It's about consumers. People thank us for giving them great coffee at a good price that they can feel good about. So we have a great impact to our consumers as well, not just our producers. And then obviously our staff, seeing these people that come and work for us and grow and evolve as individuals and can provide more for their families by, you know, gaining knowledge and experience and getting paid better. I mean, it's that. It's the result of a life with intention creating something, you know, positive and productive for others.
I love that. Mark, I understand your first facility was here in Rockville, Maryland. You also have another one in Miami, Florida. How important is your team and surrounding yourself with the right team members?
I mean, it's critical. Obviously, it's interesting. It's been one of the bigger challenges, because as we grow very quickly and very, you know, reactively sometimes to like the fact that we're just a company that companies seek out and some of the bigger companies seek out. I think having a good team around us is the most important thing. Also learning to trust people to not only deliver on their jobs and their responsibilities, but grow into them. It can be one of the more frustrating parts of running a business, because I'm, like I said, I'm a very results, very kind of like, so for me, the process of getting there and having somebody come with me to get them to their you know, that can be tough, but I think it's also one of the more rewarding things, you know, having good people that I think the passion and the like intent that I see in the people that work with my orga, I don't see anywhere else. You know, during the pandemic, I was literally saying like, hey guys, I think we should close the facility. I'm, no, we're going to do this. We're going to do that. We're going to stagger production. We're going to run three shifts instead of one and everybody will be distanced. And I was like arguing with my own staff to who wanted to keep working when I was like, you don't have to work. I'll still pay you. But the passion is that's mm-hmm. what's exciting to me. So, but yeah, it's important to have skills and it's important to have, you know, focus and it's important to deliver on your, you know, obligations and deliverables, but that's just part of being an adult. You know, to me, that's like the given of the business. It's more, are you passionate and are you willing to really do what it takes to be part of this thing? Because we're not your traditional company by any means.
I love how your team behaved and reacted there when COVID, as far as they wanted to continue, you know, and it sounds like the culture there is amazing. What are some things that you guys there are doing internally to sort of breed that or have that within your team? Because not every company has that. Many do not.
Most don't. Most companies are terrible. And most employees hate their own employee. To me, any human interaction is a relationship. You know, a lot of people think I'm not a very social person. I don't have that many relationships, but it's because I value the ones I have. And I value my relationship with our staff because to me, them deciding to come every day and be part of something I completely believe in is one of the more like, you know, interesting connections I can have with somebody. And for them to make that part of their lives, I feel like I'm indebted to them in some way. And I think it's the nature of how we see that relationship. I think, you know, our bigger struggle is when we bring new people in and they don't trust that. They don't believe it, you know, and they're almost like, you can see like they want to find ways to take advantage and like work less and clock in late and do this and that. And it takes a little time to build that trust to be like, no, this is legitimate. Like, you know, I have an $18 an hour minimum wage. We have very liberal policies on vacation. We, you know, when work from home and the education from home kicked in, we realized that not all our employees had good Wi-Fi or laptops for their kids. And we put money together and gave it out for them to be able to be at peace with that. I think it's just recognizing that it's a relationship and you can't run a business. I mean, I was just having this conversation with my nephew actually about the businesses that have been using people as chess pieces are in a lot of trouble right now. And I think people are just waking up and realizing like, I don't want to be a chess piece. My life has meaning and my values have meaning and my vision has meaning. And I want to work with a company that values that. You know, there's going to be some people who will be a chess piece to be able to make $500,000 and they'll sell, you know, part of their values and ethics for that. But I think that's just it, you know, and honestly, one of the big things too is being honest with people, good and bad, right? As long as it's done with respect, anybody that interacts with me can tell you like they know where they stand with me and they know where they stand with our management team. And I think that's a very basic human respect element that a lot of people miss, which is this kind of like, hey, this is something we can work on. This is, but I think just treating people like this is a relationship. And also, frankly, defining our company purpose in 2012, 13, and writing it out and making it a policy that we will only recruit people who find something in that purpose that really kind of hits them personally. They don't have to be from Latin America. They don't have to be all about, but it's that the premise of that purpose is it make you wake up in the morning and want to come to work. That's been a big differentiator for us as well.
Can you share that purpose with us?
It's to eliminate systemic poverty in Latin America through the direct trade of artisanal organic foods. So it's very long. Most companies will probably keep that on the back end. We put it very forward. Most people think it's too lofty or we're just lying and making it up. But that is, and honestly, the reason it came up is what I've been through as I built the company and the challenges. There's been moments where I want to quit. There's been moments where I'm like, I can't do this anymore. Whether it's lawsuits or, you know, debt or whatever we had to go through. And I woke up one day, I'm like, I have to understand why I keep waking up and pushing through this because there's something strained. And I didn't want to believe that I was just too dumb to know any better. So I was like, and I literally just kind of wrote down, like, what matters to me? Why am I doing this? And that's what I wrote out. It wasn't some marketing company. It wasn't some like, let's create it. It was more like, why do I do this? Why did I start this? And why am I willing to give up a career? You know, inevitably I give up a marriage. I mean, just the things I'm willing to go through have to have a purpose. And that's what I wrote down. Literally, it was like a 10-minute process. I'm like, that was the purpose.
And you wrote this down in what year, you said? The purpose
2013.
Came out? 2013. So during dark moments, and you've said you had many, there was many times that you were close to bankruptcy, as you jokingly said. That purpose was sort of that guiding light for you to just continue to get up and continue to move forward.
I didn't know it as definitively and as it wasn't, you know, worded out. But yeah, it was that. And honestly, I've always had a sense of obligation of the fact that I did nothing to not be born the kid that has to pick up pieces of wood to make a dollar a day. I didn't earn my place in where I was born. I didn't, and I just felt like maybe even a little sense of guilt around that. And I was like, you know, and maybe I say guilt, but I think it translates more to obligation. I kind of feel like, well, I was one of the ones that got out. I was one of the ones that was born in a place where I could come to the U.S. My dad was smart enough at 16 to kind of shift the trajectory of his family by coming to learn English. I can't just kind of piss that away. I mean, it just, to me, it's just like, you can't do that. You know, it's just like, you're given certain gifts, and whatever gifts you've given, and we each have something that, you know, if you don't recognize that that's what, whether you believe in God or whatever it is, it was given to you for a reason. If you don't do something with it, it's a disservice to that. And so for me, I think that's been a very heavy kind of driver.
I agree. Especially, I was just recently having a conversation with my wife about this, how, you know, all this thing here we're seeing as far as America, you know, there's no one perfect. There's no perfect country anywhere in the world, but people bashing America, this problem. And I'm like, people don't appreciate. People have not seen what's out there. And not that I've seen, and there's terrible things that I haven't seen or experienced myself out of what I've seen when you visit a third world country or anything like that. You mentioned Uganda, and I'm sure other countries in Africa as well. And here they are in America, and some of them may be from immigrants' parents, or some of them are American. And I just can't wrap my head around that.
Yeah, I think part of it is, and I always try to explain the difference between sympathy and empathy. You know, I think a lot of people see these things, but they go back to their nice life and go to the country club and do whatever they do and forget about it. And that's, they're sympathetic to the moment. I think when you're empathetic to somebody and to a situation, you know somebody who's lived it. You've lived it yourself. You've had a taste of it. And that empathy kind of sticks to you, right? You can't shake it. You can't, you know, come back from your little trip where you help build a house and you feel like, okay, my job's done and I'm going to go back. You can't. And I think personally, that's why in my industry, I can't stand my own industry, because I think my industry created a lot of the issues that is now pretending to want to fix. And I think one of the bigger issues is that it's an industry led and guided by people who have zero involvement in our countries, you know, and we're talking about, you know, Central America, South America, Indonesia, Africa, all these things. But we'd have these kids from Portland telling us what's good, what's not, what's acceptable, what's... So there's just plenty of, you know, and a lot of, even the sympathy is fake. So mm-hmm. I think it's just the people who really care about these things, and they're the future of the industry. I'm kind of like the old guy that's trying to prove that, you know, and hopefully by the time I retire or whatever, there's 90% of the industry is a lot of me's, you know, and a lot of my orgas, because that's what needs to happen for things to really change. For my company purpose to even have a chance, you know, Latinos and people from Africa and Indonesia and everywhere need to stand up and just jump in.
I agree. Martin, you started your first company at young in college with a cigar company. What advice, if someone came to you and said, I want to start a company, whatever company it may be, what advice would you give that person?
Don't take equity from anybody and do it yourself.
Bootstrap.
Because honestly, I think the biggest fallacy, and for some reason we've taken this, and I tell people when they raise equity, I'm like, you just sold your future at a discount. That's all the raising equity is. Unless somebody comes to you and says, hey, I love your product, I'm going to buy $5 billion worth. And then you say, okay, I need them. But for some reason we've made it sexy to sell our future by bringing investors in. And frankly, most investors, if you're the founder, they don't have a tenth of the passion and drive that you have for that vision. Just suck it up and get through it yourself. And you're going to make mistakes. But guess what? You won't be losing other people's money while you do it and liquidating your own value. Because most people who, once they start that, it's like a drug. Once they give up a piece of equity, then the Series B comes and then Series C, and then we're going to perform and we're going to liquidate. And all of a sudden you own 2% of your vision and your dream, and you're irrelevant in something that you created. And I think that, to me, that's what differentiates true entrepreneurs. The true entrepreneur is going to build something and just suck it up and, you know, eat tuna from a can for 10 years if they need to. But that's somebody that really believes in what they're doing. This whole thing where it's cool to sell your future at a discount, I think is kind of pathetic. So, you know, and understand that honestly, presence and moving forward one step forward after the other over time, it does aggregate into something positive. You just have to be patient.
It's so true. The last couple of years, the cool and sexy thing is how many billions or this last round, and then you read the headlines and Forbes or Fortune, Bloomberg, whatever it may be, this another unicorn, but you're giving a big piece of the pie that you're not or your team does not have.
Well, most Series A's funding is set up so that you don't perform, and then Series B they just take you. I mean, it's so clear that, you know, and I have the blessing of, again, I'm still a finance nerd and I love that world, but I see so many entrepreneurs are so naive that, you know, if you get a valuation that's probably 20 times what you think it should be, it's because you're being set up to fail on that valuation. So that when you need the Series B, they're going to say, well, you underperformed by 72%. And now it's worth this. So guess what? The 10% we bought at this value, now we're going to buy 50% at a fraction of that. And you're now no longer a majority owner. So, but, you know, everybody's different. Everybody has different wants and needs. And for some people, playing the entrepreneur game is enough, whether they make an impact or not, or whether they make money or not sometimes.
Martha, do you have any daily habits or skills that have helped you throughout personally or throughout your career?
I exercise a lot. I tend to negate that with a lot of eating, but I think for me, working out is just a moment of like being in my head and just in my head with that work thoughts and marketing and ideas. And so just having music and having like a purpose of something I do. I off and on meditate. I do transcendental meditation. Sometimes I'm just not in the headspace to do it and I slack off. But when I'm in the groove and I'm meditating, I definitely am in a better place. The biggest thing is I do is I wake up early, I brew a pot of coffee, and anything pending is off my docket by 7:30 in the morning, 7 a.m. So 5 to 7, whatever, it's just like, I'm going to clear everything out and maybe even get a little ahead so that I'm not feeling like I'm just chasing everything every day. And so that way I can control my day.
So you're working from 5 to 7 or 5 to 7, that's when you're sort of doing your workout or possibly meditating?
5 to 7 is coffee and catch-up time. It's literally on my calendar as coffee and catch-up, you know? And it's more than anything, just so that by 7, when most people are just waking up, I'm into my day. I'm working out after that. By 9, when people get into the office, like I've lived half a day already, you know, and it makes me feel like I'm ahead.
Yeah.
Whether it's right or wrong, I don't know, but that's kind of what I've convinced myself of.
I tried TM for a bit, but I couldn't get into it. I mean, but as far as the exercise, I'm just like that. Every morning I wake up, it's my form of therapy, just me alone in my head. With just me and the iron, that's all I need. Mm-hmm. And then I'm happy. That's my happy place. And then I feel like I can, and when I miss it, Martin, I feel like my days are off.
Big time. No, you feel, it's not even a physical thing. It's just like, and that's, I have a
it's a mental thing for me. Now. Yeah,
exactly. And I'm 48. I mean, for me, it's like my body hurts. I shouldn't even be lifting weights, but I don't even do it to like look big. It's just the challenge of it. My son, it's cool. Cause I have a son now who's just turned 15 and my lesson to him, and he works out with me, I'm like, this is a moment where you come in, you know what you have to do. That's your only goal. That's your only focus. And this is what you see what you're made of. When no one else is looking, when no one else is pushing you, and it's you trying to struggle to do whatever it is, 7 reps or whatever you're trying to get to, this is where you see what you're made of. And it sounds corny, but those moments are what prepares you for the tougher moments in life when you really have to kind of see who you are and pull from that. So it's kind of interesting, you know, having my son be a part of that and helping him understand the way I view it, at least, you know, and that's how I treat it. You know, I'm like, this is between me and myself, and I'm going to see what I'm really made of and what I can really push through in terms of I'm tired, I'm hungry, I just ate, I don't want to work out, or I just, this is hard, you know. That's what I like about it too. It's like, it's like me and myself, me against myself.
Yeah, no, it's true. I agree with you 100%. What would you say is your biggest challenge right now with your role at Mayorga?
Honestly, it's interesting because we're diving really into direct to consumer. It's like everybody else. It just took off, right? But it was always big for us. But through COVID and everything and this just exponential growth we've seen in it, I started researching that world more and digital marketing and all that. And I think the biggest challenge is that I'm so excited about it that I don't know how to like put it together. You know, one of my biggest things is that I definitely have ADD, you know, off the charts. So I kind of want to do it all. And then I feel like I'm not going to do any of it. So I brought in actually a very qualified director of marketing, and she's going to really help us kind of put that together and execute on it. Because I think my challenge right now is like, I'm so excited about what we can do. And but I don't even know where to begin because I bought 17 books, a stack of 17 books on marketing, starting with marketing for dummies, you know, like, digital marketing for dummies.
Okay.
But that's it. I mean, honestly, other than that, it's staying focused too. Right. You know, there's a $250,000 cold brew system in Miami. There's the cacao system, things that I kind of get into where I'm like, you know, that's not really going to move the needle for us. I got to go divest out of that. Just staying focused. And, that's a lifelong issue.
You know, that the DTC market, direct to consumer, there's just, especially with COVID, like you mentioned, it's been a lot of growth and it's going to continue to even grow more.
Yeah. And frankly, I think we're probably one of the best poised companies to leverage it because, you know, through our customers, I sell into millions of households every year. Mm-hmm. We have 23 years of history. We have a legitimate engagement with producers. And my dream is to connect consumers and farmers. So what better way to do it than through the internet? It's like, here you go. And I'm just kind of like adding value and then handing it off. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, I mean, they already know your brand. I mean, your brand is known for sure.
That's the benefit. Our brand is very well known, and most of the retailers we sell to only sell a smattering of our coffee. So we can create a DTC strategy that doesn't take away from our consumers, I mean, our wholesale customers, but gives consumers, you know, better insight into some of the things we do. And honestly, one of the biggest things that I feel good about is that we're completely Latino-focused, owned, managed. We only buy coffees from Latin America. And I'm going to be out there, you know, putting Latinos on the map in a positive light and talking about, you know, not only our coffee, but our culture, our food, our countries, our architecture, our history. That's exciting to me. And I think people are into that as well. You know, I think Latinos haven't had the platform that we've deserved for a long time.
Yeah, I agree. What do you know now, Martin, that you wish you would have known at the start of your career?
That sometimes working too deeply based on my principles isn't the best thing for business. Meaning, I mentioned earlier, I feel like marketing is kind of a smoke and mirrors kind of BS game, but it's the game you have to play. And I'm just starting to come to grips with that. You know, frankly, even this podcast, I wouldn't have accepted 6 months ago. I wouldn't accept the speaking engagements. I just feel like it used to make me feel fraudulent to do the things I believe in and then talk about them. Because I was like, oh, now it seems like I'm just talking about it. And that's why I do them. So I can actually go hype myself up. But, you know, I think my principles need to kind of come back a little bit. And I have to recognize the practicality of the business world and also the practicality of consumers, where they don't necessarily know everything. They don't care about the things to the depth that I do. So I do have to talk about it. I do have to kind of highlight what we do because it is relevant, it is important, and it does make an impact. So I think just having too deep a focus on your principles, which is a very rare thing, so it's probably advice that only 1% of the population will even care about. Other than that, I mean, I'll be honest with you, if I knew what it took to get to where I am, I don't think I would do it. You know, I think what I tell people all the time, it was the small victories leading to this and the small failures leading to this. But if somebody had put a time machine on my brain and showed me everything I took, I don't think I would have had the stomach to get through it, or I wouldn't have thought I would. So I think it's just focus on the small wins and build on them.
So would you redo it again now seeing the trajectory, or would you have said, hey, let me just go international banking, finance, or?
I would do it again.
Okay.
Honestly, because I don't see anything as negative or as a failure. Even like my first lawsuit and deposition, that was a learn. I learned a lot, and it was almost fun because I enjoy learning. So even though it was stressful and scary, I was like, I got to sit in the deposition and do this. And, you know, when we had a fire and the insurance company didn't pay and I had to sue them and resue them and go to stressful back then. But, you know, and to me, learning is part of the joy of, you know, being alive. So I wouldn't change anything, to be honest.
Yeah. Hopefully it's not that big of a costly learning experience.
Yeah, I've lost a lot of money and I've made dumb mistakes, but, you know, again, I don't measure my life through money or my happiness or my progress. Society does, but, you know, and again, because I stopped focusing on it, that part is kind of working now.
Yeah.
So I'm not too concerned about that.
Martin, when I say the word success, what is the first thing that comes to mind?
Freedom. For me, I'm a big believer in freedom and success. And to some people, freedom means I make enough money to do whatever I want. For me, it means that I can sit here wearing a t-shirt and shorts talking to you about something I love, and knowing that we have people here in the US and Latin America working hard towards something that makes me feel good and makes them feel good. But I think it's, to me, it's just that freedom of even being yourself. You know, I think one of the things that I feel good about is I've always brought my real self to every situation. I won't dress up for you. I won't speak a certain way for you. I won't do anything that, and the freedom to be yourself is critical. And I think for me, one of the great things about owning a business is I can provide that for other people. I don't care what your preferences of any sort are, as long as you come to work, you treat other people with respect and you do your job. And I think providing that for other people, where it's like, my work is a place where you can be yourself. You can, whatever you do personally, it's accepted and it's appreciated. And just do what you got to do professionally. So that's a big one for me.
Coming to an end here soon, what does the future look? What is the next 5 years, or what's the vision for Mayorga?
Well, we bought our building in Baltimore. We're going to build that out. We're going to consolidate because I have three facilities in Maryland right now, just because we keep outgrowing everything and I have to have kind of satellite facilities for storage. But then I'm going to go into Latin America and actually make things down there and build facilities and compete with the people that created the poverty in the coffee industry through their, you know, abusive sourcing practices. So I'm going to be right next to them, hopefully funneling a lot of the coffee away from them and into our supply chains, our producers can make more money, and then getting a model together where we can add value down there and create better income in Latin America than just take stuff out and extract it.
That's great. So after Baltimore is complete, what sort of where are you planting the next flag in Latin America? What are you thinking?
Well, frankly, I have everything invested already in Nicaragua.
Okay.
Just waiting to see how things fall out politically. But I got great property in the Pan American. We have plans. We have everything ready for a mega facility that's going to bring in coffee, chia, beans, cacao. And we have logistics. Everything's planned out. We just have to see how things settle.
Where in Nicaragua?
It's on the Pan American on the way to Seattle.
Oh, okay.
You know,
okay.
Heading north. Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm excited about that. You know, we were planning something in Peru. COVID came, and now there's also political questions there. So we'll see. But my personal life will be, my wife is Costa Rican. We're flying there next weekend. We're going to be there for a few weeks. Usually we're there during harvest. You know, I want my life to be more based in Latin America.
Okay, that's good. And lastly, what do you like to do for fun when you're not busy working?
Eating and fishing. Those are two things I enjoy. I love just like going out with a group of people and ordering way too much food and just like that family kind of chaos you get out of like a big dinner. And the only thing that actually allows me to check out is fishing. You know, I go, I have my boat, I run it, I tie every knot, I do everything, and I'm so dialed in that it's almost meditative and allows me to be so in the moment, which is something I struggle with, like nothing else. So for me, where everybody else wants to go fish and drink, like for me, it's like, it's meditation. It's like just a really cool thing to disassociate a little bit with the moment and create a new moment, you know, that I'm really into.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're in South Florida, so it's perfect for that.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's convenient. Yeah, definitely. And traveling, my wife, you know, I'm remarried and we've been married for about a year and then together for about 5.5. And we share a love for just traveling wherever, whenever we can go, we want to go see it. So that's a big one for me too.
So besides Latin America, what's sort of the next place you and the wife plan to travel internationally?
You know, it's funny, we were talking about it and we actually had a trip to Hawaii booked, but people are traveling so much that everything's a little bit hectic. So we canceled it because I was like, I don't want to go to a place where it's hard to get reservations and this and that. Again, I like rustic, you know, like we're going to Costa Rica and we'll just go out and drive to the coastline and just find like a town, not like a resort or anything like that. I want to drive to Panama and go fishing in Panama. But right now it's just more, I want to be in Latin America. Okay. And frankly, if you ask me, like, to go anywhere in the world, that I'd say I just want to be in Latin America, especially Central America right now. Sure, I'd love to go to Italy and eat well. I'd love to go to, you know, Switzerland and snowboard, but I love being in Latin America. I feel good there.
Yeah. Well, it's home.
I almost feel like I can eat whatever I want in Central America and not gain weight.
It's like, oh, really?
I don't know if it's more like natural ingredients, but we always laugh because, like, I eat so much there and I lose weight.
But, Mark, what are you going to do, though, when you're there for a couple of weeks? I mean, that's the thing I have. You know, I could take a break as far as not working out, but I'm doing it daily. And if I go to Nicaragua for a couple of weeks, I mean, unless I become a member somewhere, I don't know. But it's a different life when you're there.
Well, we have a place in Costa Rica and I have kettlebells. And we.
Oh, so you're ready. You're prepared. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I mean, my son and I will travel. Like when we go on the boat, even if we go sleep on it, we'll take a kettlebell on the boat and like we'll figure something out. Okay. And honestly, hiking and running and biking and stuff, it's not the same, but yeah. It's something.
Yeah. Martin, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Of course, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, had a lot of fun. Take care.
All right, you too.
Thanks.
If you haven't done so already, please make sure to subscribe to the show and leave a review and comment and let me know what you think. Thank you, and I'll see you all very soon on the next episode.